Welcome to A State of Readiness, a podcast set as a fireside chat with business leaders to discuss what it takes for a company to be in a state of readiness and become a high-performance organization with your host, Joseph Paris. Welcome, everyone, to State of Readiness. I'm your host, Joseph Paris. Today, I have a very special guest, Brent Gleason. Brent was a U.S. Navy SEAL and is the author of the books Taking Point and Embrace the Suck. As a SEAL, Brent has experienced parts of the world that most others will never see, not even on television. After his tours in Iraq, Africa, and other theaters of war, Brent transitioned to civilian life in the world of entrepreneurship, where he applied battle-tested leadership principles to building teams designed to overcome the odds and achieve results. He is an outstanding and selfless human being who cherishes his family and the United States, and who leaves an indelible and positive mark on all those he touches. I am really pleased to have him join me today and share with us the wisdom of his life's journey. Welcome, Brent. How are you doing today?
I'm good, brother. Good to see you.
Oh, man, it's great to have you back. You may or may not know this, but you were the very first guest on my State of Readiness podcast series. I really appreciate you taking the risk and joining me.
So, the risk might have been more yours than mine, but yeah, it's good to be back.
Yes, great. And, I really loved your first book, Taking Point. I mean, it was a really great book. And when I saw that you're working on your next project, I just couldn't wait to get a hold of it. So, once I got to the States, I was able to get a copy pretty easily on Amazon. So, for awesome. You, those of you out there, Embrace the Suck, Amazon.com is a way to get it, of course. But I want to roll this back a little bit, this conversation back. There's not too many Navy SEALs in the world, as you know. I mean, it's a very elite group. And somewhere along your life's journey, you decided that you wanted to become a Navy SEAL. Now, how does that happen?
It is kind of an interesting and somewhat humorous story in a way, at least to me it is, because I never had any lifelong aspirations for military service in general. My father had served as a Marine reservist during Vietnam, thankfully didn't have to deploy, but not something he ever really talked about nor pressed upon my twin brother or I throughout our young lives that military service was something he would be interested in seeing us pursue. And so I grew up in Dallas, did my undergraduate education at Southern Methodist University, studied at Oxford University in England as well, ultimately graduated with degrees in finance and economics. So obviously I took a job as a financial analyst with a global firm. And so I was doing the high-rise tower downtown Dallas finance job. And at that same time, I had a close friend of mine at SMU who was a year behind me in school. So he was now a senior. He was one of my fraternity brothers, actually. Now, he was, in fact, one of these young men who did have a lifelong passion, vision, a dream of one day graduating from college, joining the Navy, and at least attempting to be accepted into the notorious SEAL training pipeline. Keep in mind, this is just pre-9/11, so peacetime, a little bit of a different mindset when it comes to military service. Obviously, extremely, admirable, a call to serve, give to a cause greater than yourself. And so, I wished him well. I was like, that's great. But, from what I do know about the program, it's an extremely high attrition rate. So best of luck to you. Godspeed. But shortly thereafter, when I realized that he was very serious about this path, he and I started training together. So for me, it was just a way to stay fit, have an accountability partner. I'd been a college athlete, so I wanted to kind of maintain an appropriate degree of mental and physical wellness, and also simultaneously help a friend prepare for what seemed to be a very arduous journey ahead. And so by nature, we started spending a lot of time together on nights and weekends. Every night I'd come home from the office, I'd run 4 miles to the SMU pool. We'd swim, we'd do calisthenics, I'd run 4 miles home. On the weekends, we'd train for marathons and do a lot of different types of strength training. And as we spent more and more time together and having all this dialogue about the implications of what laid ahead, it piqued my interest. So I started doing research on the history of the Naval Special Warfare community and our forefathers from the underwater demolition teams in World War II, and how we essentially cut our teeth as an elite assault force in Vietnam. And let's just say I started leaving the office a little bit earlier every day, training a little bit harder, spending more time on the weekends training, reading more books about SEALs. And ultimately, that growing fascination, coupled with the somewhat boring nature of my entry-level financial analyst position led to the culmination of a decision to leave that temporarily behind and join him on his journey and give to a cause greater than myself and serve our country that I so deeply love. And so I left my job. He and I moved up to a little town called Crested Butte, Colorado, where we then trained for another 5 months for literally about 10 to 12 hours a day at high altitude, about 10 to 11,000 feet, to prepare our minds and bodies as much as we possibly could within our control for the program. So then in early 2000, joined the Navy, and the rest is history. So that's literally how that path was placed before me, and I chose a path slightly less traveled, and no regrets.
So I got to ask, did your buddy make it through the program too?
Well, that's actually the interesting irony of that journey is that, you know, we'd be on these long runs and we'd be joking around sometimes. Well, you know, mathematically, statistically speaking, one of us won't make it because it's right. Almost an 85, 90% failure rate, all said and done. And the sad part of the story, I'm laughing because there's kind of a twist here, is that he and I went through, we enlisted. So a lot of our special operators enlist as opposed to going the officer path. There's multiple reasons, but also depending on what you want to do as a job in the teams. Also the competitive nature of getting into a class in the first place, because there's only so many spots for officers. So like many do, we have about 70% of our enlisted SEALs have at minimum an undergrad college degree because they chose to enlist. And then many of them become officers later. So he and I enlisted. We went to, you know, we got in the same division in boot camp, filtered into the same buds class. We run 6 classes a year. So we figured we probably would based on timing, but there was no guarantee. Buds being the first 6 months of a long training pipeline, that stands for basic underwater demolition SEAL for those of you watching and listening. And because we run 6 classes a year, the people in your class are kind of filtering in from, you know, the civilian world, other branches of the military, other places and jobs in the Navy. So in that 2-month gap from when one class starts and another class starts, your class is kind of filtering in. And so they're putting the class together. You're doing just half day workouts. You're not getting your butt beat by instructors. So it's not too stressful, but you're kind of just getting absorbed into the culture and start mentally preparing your mind for what's to come. So he and I lived together in the dorms, barracks. And literally the week before we started first phase, where you class up and just, that's where the shit hits the fan. And those weeks leading up to Hell Week, and then Hell Week, you lose half your class even before Hell Week. Very difficult. So I was very sick that week, but because we hadn't classed up, they're not going to medically roll you back. They just let you heal and get better. And so that weekend, literally that weekend before we classed up, I got better and we were roommates and he got sick. He got what I had. Horrible flu. Oh, no. 104 fever, and literally, you know, day one, day two, day three, they're not going to medically roll you back typically.
Right.
It's get out there and perform or sorry. And so basically he got forcibly medically dropped, which is, I mean, literally by day three, I believe it was awful. And there's a silver lining to the story. He was placed in PhysSec, or, you know, physical security, base security, for a little while until he took another path within the Navy for a very brief time and rather quickly was accepted to do what we call a lateral transfer to the Army, because he also had a lifelong passion to be a pilot as well, possibly even more so than being a SEAL. So he went through a warrant officer program in the Army, became a helicopter pilot, flew UH-60s, medevac helicopters, 12 combat deployments between Iraq and Africa. Then he did a transfer to the Air Force. Now he's a captain in the Air Force running one of our top secret drone programs. So he's had actually a really illustrious military career. So
that's pretty awesome. You know, it's, life has got twisty paths, doesn't it?
God works in mysterious ways, my friend.
Indeed. Indeed. I don't want to see his instruction manual either.
No. It's best we don't see it.
Right. So, you know, your first book, you know, Taking Point, it really, you know, what I got out of it is, you know, what it takes, what are some of the characteristics, what should a leader keep in mind in order to, you know, be that leader. And what I got out of it, one of the things I got out of it is that, you know, you're not a leader because of a rank. You know, you're a leader because people are willing to follow is you know, really the bottom line. But this book, Embrace the Suck, that seems to be much more internal, inwardly focused than taking point. You know, it's like, what can we do to harden ourselves, you know, mentally, spiritually, physically, and why is that important? And some of the things that I got out of it was, first off, you have to try to figure out what is important. Because if everything's important, nothing's important, right?
Right. And, 10 priorities means no priorities.
exactly right. So you know, these are the things that I got out of it. And, you know, I've been in business since 1985, and I've had a lot of body blows over that time. You know, you can't be in business for that many years without having to embrace the suck every once in a while.
If not, you're doing something wrong.
Yeah, exactly right, you know. And there was one moment in my career in particular. It was early 2000s. Okay, so now I'm in business almost 20 years or so, a little over 20 years. And it was a real, real tough spot for me, you know, a real tough patch. And there was a gentleman, a good friend of mine, who's from the UK, was living in South Africa at the time. And, you know, I shared with him my struggling. And he says, "Don't worry about it, Joe. You've been here before and you always find a way through it. So you're in, you know, you're in the middle of the soup right now, but, you know, just you will figure out a way to get through it." And sure as shit, you know, I did. You know, and the interesting thing was that conversation, you know, made me realize and, you know, reflect. It was like, you know what? He's right. Every time I've, you know, faced a peril, I've been able to figure out a way through it. Now, why should this time be any different? So that really took a whole lot of pressure off. Not that I had to sit back now and it was inevitable, but I knew that, you have to do the work. But you know what? You know, why should this time be any different? So when you wrote this book, what was the message? What was the lesson? You know, what was the inspiration that you wanted to share with your audience?
It's kind of part of a collective journey. I mean, when I transitioned out of the teams after several combat deployments, I dove headfirst into the world of entrepreneurship, which arguably has the same failure rate as SEAL training when it comes to startup success. So I'd somehow along the path of my life gained a taste for calculated risk. Mm-hmm. And so I before writing Taking Point, I had built and sold two companies. Writing Taking Point was actually a strategic next step to building my third company or organization, which is now Taking Point Leadership. So I wanted to, you know, put all these thoughts around sort of modern day change management, change leadership, how to lead an organization through any type of significant or even micro transformation. And a lot of it learning from my shortcomings, failures, and some, you know, marginal successes in leading and building two high growth companies. And obviously inspired by many of the business and entrepreneurship books that I had written and the research and studying I'd done and things I learned in grad school and all those things coming together to say, well, maybe there's an opportunity here to write a book that is an inspiration for, you know, what the modern 21st century organization looks like, how they navigate what is now constant change. Very aligned with General Stanley McChrystal's team of teams. They're following book one mission. General McChrystal did the front cover blurb for that book. So that was really awesome. And in building a company around organizational transformation and leadership development, obviously you can't enhance the performance and rituals, mindset, behavior, and actions of a team to achieve a desired outcome if you can't transform, you know, the people within the team. So I was like, well, maybe there's a sort of, for lack of a better phrase, a self-help opportunity here within that genre, which is arguably the largest genre when it comes to books and podcasts and things like that. It's a multi-billion dollar industry, if we want to call it that. And much of the inspiration of Embrace the Suck, subtitled The Navy SEAL Way to an Extraordinary Life, stems from a lot of what we teach leaders and managers in the organizations we work with on how to develop their own emotional intelligence, how to use adversity, stress, and anxiety as a pathway towards enlightenment and gaining wisdom. Just like you said, you know, you're not going to achieve any level of success, however we want to define that, or navigate the uncertainty of the business world without a little pain and suffering along the way. Right. Yet you gain wisdom through that, as long as you're taking stock of, you know, your current reality and applying lessons learned so you don't make the same mistakes over again, or you navigate certain levels of adversity more quickly and come out stronger the other end as we go through that path. And so the first step was, well, maybe I should do a little research in this self-help space. I'd never read a self-help book before. I'd only read business books. And so what I found were obviously books out there that are wildly popular and pretty diverse when it comes to tackling, you know, personal transformation and helping people improve their personal and professional lives. A lot of fluff, a lot of happy talk. You know, some that I thought found really interesting were very counterintuitive approaches to self-help. I love Mark Manson's work. It's creative. It's interesting. Like his first book, The Subtle Art of Not Giving a F, and his follow-on book, Everything is F'd. Yeah. A book about hope. It's very creative writing. I was like, there's something here. You're starting to see an emergence of people connecting less with, you know, have a positive mindset and, you know, think happy, more so like gritty in your face, tough love, you know, unfuck yourself type of like, you know, take action, you know,
right.
And especially now. And then the timing of the book was interesting because going into the project, of course, didn't realize that 2020 was going to suck so bad. So it literally came out, as you know, December 22nd, a few months ago, right at the end of 2020, a tough year for everybody. So in all seriousness, it has been so far proven to be a really great tool of not just inspiration for people, but for action. And that could be saving a small business, transforming a business, enhancing your personal life, navigating the uncertainties of COVID from a financial perspective, to mending relationships, to battling cancer, trying to, you know, impact all walks of life through some of the lessons we can learn around mental fortitude, grit, and resilience, and not just from the SEAL teams or the World of Special Operations, but from other inspirational individuals, world-renowned athletes, historical figures, explorers, you know, different types of experiences we can learn from about what it really means to navigate adversity.
Now, it's interesting that you say that because, you know, I'm a little bit, you know, I got a little bit more gray hair than you, right? So I got some more miles under. Well, I guess, you know, you've traveled more than I do, so you have more miles under your feet than I do. But, you know, when I was young in business, the planning was a lot longer. You know, people would put in 5-year, 10-year plans. You know,
the 5-year plan.
Yeah, the 5-year plan. You know, the communists came up, the Soviets came up with a 5-year plan every year and never made a one of them. But but a lot of these, we'll call them, legacy businesses. These businesses that have been around for a long time, they're still stuck in the mode where they're planning. I mean, in absolute terms, they're planning, not notional terms. They're planning in absolute terms what it's going to be in a 5-year time frame or a 10-year time frame. Yeah. And they don't understand that, you know, the world could turn upside down on a dime.
I mean, well, now we know.
Yeah, now we know, right. And, you know, when I wrote my book, State of Readiness, I mean, I was talking about that. It's like you've got to, you know, prepare your company for the uncertainty that exists in the world. I mean, and I made proposed that, you know, your competition is not the people that make the same product or offer the same services. Your enemy is time. Yeah. You know, it's the only fixed variable that exists. And, you know, you can't make more of it. You know what I mean? If I waste an hour today, I could work an extra hour, but I cannot reclaim that hour.
Yeah.
And we have to be able to make decisions from, you know, imperfect data. And it was really interesting when COVID hit. If you think a year and a half ago, if you and I were addressing one of our clients in a corporate boardroom and said, you know what, you could all work from home, we would be laughed out of that conference room. You know, we would still hear the echoes of the laughter today.
You'd be like,
you know, what? Yeah, exactly. But, you know, here along comes one COVID pandemic, and within 2 weeks, everybody was working from home.
Yep.
So, you know, the thing is, how much data do you have to collect and analyze to make a decision? And when do we make a decision?
Right.
You know, and I propose that we make a decision when our level of confidence exceeds our level of fear.
I like that. Can I use that? I'm going to use that.
Yeah, you can use that. Use that, sure. So, you know, your books and your messaging really resonates with me. And I also agree with you that, you know, I've never gravitated towards the happy, friendly people holding hands leadership book. You know what I mean? I mean, you mentioned emotional intelligence, absolutely critical. You know what I mean? We have to, it's part and parcel of forming and keeping a team. You know, we have to know what people tick, what makes people tick, what makes them disengage. We have to know this about ourselves, you know, what sets us on tilt, and how do we manage and navigate through all these different personalities to keep them aligned and committed to a universal goal that's known in absolute terms.
Oh yeah. I mean, and that's what we help coach and teach into organizations, you know, with my company, Takeaway Leadership. But, you know, obviously with COVID, you're not necessarily changing the rules of the game when it comes to great leadership and engagement strategies and creating high performing teams that navigate change successfully. It's just more complex now with isolation and working remote. How do you manage and lead a remote team? How do you keep them engaged in a well-run organization that still only has about 35% engagement with the rest of those teams being actively or passively disengaged? Well, what are the numbers going to look like next year when the data comes out about 2020 and beyond with everybody working remote?
Yeah.
And engagement, you know, going to definitely plummet a little bit.
Yeah.
Now, again, to your point, a lot of organizations and even clients we work with have, not that we're taking credit for their success, but have pivoted very quickly and very successfully, forced down the path of digital transformation, forced down the path of learning how to effectively lead and manage remote teams. And some of our clients, for example, because of, you know, rapid changes, maybe not necessarily significant changes, but rapid changes to how the business is capitalized, to their revenue streams, to obviously looking at their budgets and, you know, exiting wasteful spending and a lot of stuff that you're like, oh my God, I can't believe we waste money on that. Just get rid of that. Get rid of that. Have come out of this more profitable, more scalable, more efficient, more adaptable. Like a couple of our big clients made more money last year than they've ever made before because they quickly adjusted the capitalization of the business, how they invested in their, you know, their talent base and, you know, obviously endless amounts of other types of actions they took. But like you said, they took massive action based on imperfect data with, you know, decent contingencies in place for course correction, but they took action. And the organizations, as we know, we saw this back in 2008, that are too slow to adapt, oftentimes don't even survive, you know, much less, you know, just barely kind of eke along their path to, you know, to running the business. So.
I've, you know, and you have too, no doubt. A lot of the leaders that I've spoken with have actually shared that they've seen a tremendous increase in productivity. You know, and I would assume that this is even more true of major metro areas where people don't have to commute an hour and a half or so each way every day. You know, there's a bit more of a work-life balance. But and we're only a year into this, right? A year and a couple of weeks right into this. But I wonder, long-term, how do we keep a cohesive team if we don't actually break bread with one another? You know what I mean? And I, you know, maybe for a year, you know, we reap the rewards of additional productivity, but I wonder if we don't train together, you know, if we don't work together tighter, do we run the risk of being disengaged, you know, untethered, if you will, to one another, especially as new people come on board that haven't been immersed in the corporate culture or things like that?
Yeah, it's I wrote an article for my Forbes column yesterday. I've touched on this topic, of course, a couple times over the past year, but, you know, how to effectively lead and manage a remote team and thinking about engagement. And a lot of our clients, for example, have onboarded numerous new team members that they've never met. They've never met in person. They've never managed them in person. They've never broken bread with them. They've never been in a social environment with them, much less a professional environment. But unfortunately, to use a cliche term, that's just the new normal. But I do think that without careful and strategic thinking about how we continue to evolve in a remote environment due to the uncertainty of when organizations, their policies, sometimes are up to them. Sometimes it's up to, you know, their state, their country. We work with a client right now in Malta, and it's the blessing and curse of virtual availability. We ran their first training session from 11:30 p.m. to 5 a.m. the other last week. But, you know, it's, you know, they were going to have this leadership meeting. They're all going to an offsite location in a hotel, you know, conference room, and they're going to have social time. And then literally 2 days before we did the event, like, we can't do it. So we had to do it all virtually. So that constant shifting back and forth really does cause fatigue for team members, for even the most well-intentioned leaders. So we're going to have to continue to be really creative in how we shift those engagement strategies to maintain certain levels of collaboration and cross-functional work and keeping people engaged when it comes to innovation and how they help utilize their talent to drive the business forward. There are ways to do it. It's imperfect, but I don't think it's ever been perfect.
I think this is going to be fodder for a whole new series of business books, and how to manuals, it's just like I concern myself with presently, mechanically and tactically, we've been able to get through this as, businesses have been able to work through this, but I'm wondering about the strategic impact and the impact on, having a cohesive team. When you're in SEAL training there, I mean, can you imagine doing SEAL training virtually?
I mean, what would that even mean? I made a joke about that the other day, that they're doing butts over Zoom now. And they have a higher attrition rate than when they do it in person because people just can't take it anywhere.
I would imagine so.
The Zoom fatigue far exceeds the fatigue of actual physical training. Excellent. So you mentioned that.
But, so what do you think is, I don't want to say the five-year future because nobody knows that, right? But what do you think is in the immediacy as we try to figure out what a new norm is and what does a high-performance team look like, do you think, coming on through the other side?
I think we're going to continue to see the development of hybrid models in organizations. That's the big debate as well. When does the day come? Just like you joked earlier, if a year and a half ago we said, hey, by the way, one last thing, everybody's can work from home. People have been so confused. Some people have been great, and other people wouldn't even know what to do with that type of information. Well, conversely, when is that day, if that day ever comes, where organizations are like, all right, on Tuesday, we're all coming back to the office, business as usual. Well, that's going to cause a sort of a similar but different ripple effect in organizations where people have gotten used to working remote. Many people want to, again, we work very closely with clients all over the world. A lot of people are over this. They want to get back, with their team in an office setting so they can, more effectively have that social connection, that ability to face-to-face collaborate with their team members, while others in different types of roles in the organization don't really need to be there, or maybe they don't want to be there. So mm-hmm. most organizations I've seen, large and small, are starting to at least plan for some type of hybrid where some of their teams will be in certain locations, some won't be. But again, that goes into also how organizations are, unfortunately, for the commercial real estate professionals out there, rethinking their workplace needs and how they manage their teams. But at the same time, a lot of interesting opportunity comes out of this when it think about your talent base. Well, your talent base, in theory, could potentially be global. When it comes to where what your talent acquisition strategies are, what type of people you're looking for. If your business is based in Chicago, well, maybe those people don't have to be in Chicago. Maybe they can be in Paris. Maybe they could be in Dubai or in Texas, really, really pretty much anywhere. Yeah. So again, and like you said, too, we've seen a lot greater levels of efficiency, scalability, cost savings. So there's a lot of opportunity that can be capitalized on for businesses and for just individuals too, and how we think about our approach to life, work, wellness, faith, family. Yeah. I mean, a lot of us, for example, those of us who used to travel a lot, one of my personal and professional strategic imperatives in 2020 was to continue to build the team, bring in new talent, but also use that strategically so that I can start to, just like in any business, gradually start to pull out and work on it rather than in it so much. And wasn't really sure how that was going to work. And then a global pandemic came along and boom.
Sorted it all out.
So, yeah. So it worked out just fine.
You know, what's interesting, about 12 years ago, I had a guy, I was very localized. I thought that I had to hire people, within, a half hour drive or so of my office, hour tops. And then I had this one guy that lived on the bubble of that, on that distance. And he ended up moving out to California to be with his wife. And I'm in New York and I didn't know it for like 3 months. All right. It was a big open secret in the business. Everybody knew except for me. And it got me, but most people would think that'd be upset. And actually I was infatuated with it. It was just like, wow, he's been there for 3 months. I didn't know. Clients are happy. I didn't, it's like everything's getting done. It just opened up my eyes. And then I was like, why do I have offices? Why don't I hire the talent wherever they want? If they live in Raleigh, they want to stay in Raleigh, let them stay in Raleigh. What do I care? You know?
Yeah.
And so I went virtual, and that's one of the reasons that I moved to Germany, is because my company was now virtual. And I was doing it before it was cool, you know? Right. And
thank you for paving the way forward.
But the one thing that I did do, because working from home, it's really hard sometimes to separate home from work. You know what I mean? What is that like?
I know what you mean.
You know what I mean. Yeah, you're with me on this. So believe it or not, one of the stupid things I do, it's stupid. I know it. Everybody makes fun of me for it. Every morning when I get ready for work, I go on a 10-minute drive. Just around, you know what I mean? Around. It's a commute. But when I'm thinking about my day, you know, I'm setting up mentally my day, and, you know, call it a personal briefing, if you will. And when I get back to the house, I'm working. And at the end of the day, I do the same thing. You know what I mean? I take another 10-minute drive or so, and, you know, I'm putting away all my work stuff in my brain, and I come home and I'm pulling out all the home stuff. And when I get home, that's it. You know, I'm now at home. So it just, you know, it's just,
I like that. And we've seen too that I'm seeing that, you know, people and teams that have been really successful in adapting in this environment and working from home and trying to navigate those very, very blurred lines of, okay, you know, daddy's working or mommy's working, not available for this, that, and the other thing that come up. It's tough. Now, again, there's a blessing there too, to be able to spend that much time with the family and be available for, you know, taking short breaks and playing with the kids or taking the dogs on the walk. But it's those rituals like you're talking about, whether it's a drive, 10-minute meditation session, your morning workout routine or your lunchtime workout routine, having those breaks in between, because oftentimes a lot of us have found there's a lot of efficiency because we're actually working more now than we were before inadvertently, because we're not in the car or on an airplane or in a hotel room. You know, we have those minutes and hours back because we're not commuting as much. We're not traveling as much. We're not in the car as much.
Right.
So we're strapping in at 7 a.m. or sometimes earlier. Next thing you know, it's late in the afternoon and you didn't eat lunch. You haven't taken a break. You didn't work out. there are no breaks between your back-to-back meetings with the team. It's got to be a better balance for people from a mental wellness standpoint too, to better combat, you know, stress, anxiety, fatigue, social isolation, and just adjusting to, you know, this sort of new environment. And we've seen a lot of that, but also we've seen a lot of people who have really thrived in this environment. They're more fit than they've ever been. They've tackled that entrepreneurial opportunity. They've been put on the side burner for, you know, years and years. Like, you know what? If not now, when?
Right.
A lot of people changing career paths, transforming their business, selling their business and doing something else, or leaving the big corporation to write a book or start their own company. It's really interesting to see and almost study, you know, how, you know, the human mind reacts and seizes those opportunities. Now, not everybody does that, obviously.
Right.
Some people just throw their hands up and say, well, can't control the situation, so I'm going to do less, not more. Doesn't usually turn out well for those folks.
No, it doesn't. I mean, because time waits for nobody, right? I mean, I think the unofficial motto of the French Foreign Legion is, in the Legion, you march or you die.
Sounds fun. know?
So, I mean, that's pretty much sums it up for me, you know?
Well, it's like you're either going forward, you're either growing, or you're slowly dying. I mean, it's kind of that same philosophy.
Yeah. So, well, listen, Brent, thank you for joining me today. I really appreciated a great deal.
Absolutely.
Great insights. I would highly recommend your book, Embrace the Suck, as well as Taking Point. I think that both of them together would be a good addition to anybody's library. But remember, you don't learn anything by them sitting on the shelf. You have to actually read them.
Yep. Well, hey, again, great to see you. Glad to hear you're doing so well. And thank you so much for having me on the show again. I'm sure we'll do it again in the future. But best of luck and love to your family.
Thank you very much, Brent. Take care. Thank you very much.
Thanks. Bye.
Bye. Thank you for listening to State of Readiness. You can discover more episodes and learn about the book written by Joseph Paris of the same title at www.state-of-readiness.com. You can learn more about Joseph Paris at www.josephparis.me/card.